Hello, and welcome to Learning English, the daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America in Washington. This program is designed to help people like you learn everyday American English. This is what you will hear on today's program. In our weekly higher education report, correspondent Pete Musto will tell us about a new report showing how state support for public universities is still below pre-recession levels. Then you will hear Words and Their Stories, one of our most popular programs. This week, Ana Mateo will tell us about the word circle and many expressions that use the word. And we will present The Making of a Nation. Now, here is Pete Musto.
Public colleges and universities in the United States depend heavily on financial support from the states in which they are located. But a new report shows the level of support for these schools is still well below what it was 10 years ago, before the Great Recession of 2008. The State Higher Education Executive Officers Association, or SHEEO, released the report in April. It looked at the average amount of money per student each state in the U.S. gave to its public universities for the 2016 fiscal year. It also looked at the national overall average of state spending per student on public higher education. George Pernsteiner is the president of the SHEEO. He says the economic recession marked a difficult period for state funding of public universities. Only five American states, Indiana, Montana, Nebraska, North Dakota, and Wyoming, are still spending as much or more on public higher education as they were in 2008. Overall, the national average of per student spending is still 17% below what it was since the recession. Pernsteiner says that state support of public higher education has long been an important part of American history. In 1862, the U.S. Congress passed the Land-Grant College Act. This gave federal lands to the states where they could build public universities to better educate their populations. Founding these schools meant the states were making an investment in their own future, he says.
The reason they do it is to improve their society and economy. An educated population is viewed as necessary for both civic engagement and for economic development and growth. So in founding them, they have taken some responsibility for their operation and their support.
Some states have taken steps toward trying to get back to the pre-2008 levels of support for public colleges and universities. In fact, since 2012, the national average of state spending on public higher education began increasing. However, 2016 marked the first change in that trend. The national average of state spending for public institutions was $130 less per student in 2016 than it was in 2015. This marks the first decrease in 4 years. Why the decrease? Education spending in the six large American states can greatly affect the national average. They are California, Texas, Florida, New York, Pennsylvania, and Illinois. In 2016, the state of Illinois reduced its funding of public higher education by 80%. This decrease is so large that if the study had not included Illinois, the national average would have shown an increase. Larry Dietz is the president of Illinois State University, the oldest public university in the state. He says state funding normally covers 18% of the university's budget. However, for the past 2 years, the state governor and the state legislature have been unable to agree on a state budget. This means public institutions in the state have only received the smallest amount of financial support possible. Dietz says his school has had to leave 120 non-teaching jobs unfilled because of the cuts. He notes that any state in the U.S. needs to consider what cuts like this mean for their local economies. Also, they should consider how they are viewed nationally.
The overall question that elected officials really need to answer is, what do they want higher education to look like in the future?
Richard Ekman is the president of the Council of Independent Colleges, an organization that represents almost 700 private colleges in the U.S. He says states should allow students to use state scholarships at private colleges and universities. This would let more students make use of the opportunities in private schools that they might not otherwise be able to pay for. I'm Pete Musto.
Now the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. On this program, we explore the origins and usage of words and expressions that we use every day in our conversations. Sometimes this show begins with a simple word. Then it builds and builds into a long story with many different expressions. Today, we start with the word circle. Let's see where this circle leads us. A circle is simple and elegant. Mathematicians describe it as 360 degrees traveling endlessly around and around. The expression circle of life comes from this idea. Living creatures are constantly being born and dying, over and over, like a circle. Many of the circle expressions we will learn today mean just that, to go around and around while thinking, speaking, or doing just about anything. Let's continue with the phrase going around in circles. This expression means to spend a lot of time and effort trying to get something done without making any progress. If some problem in your life has you going around in circles, it's best to stop thinking about it for a while and clear your mind. Now, to run around in circles, or to run in circles, is not a type of exercise. If you are running in circles, you are wasting time doing an activity that has no purpose or end. For example, I was planning to clean and organize my apartment over the weekend. It seemed like a simple task, but for hours I just kept running around in circles. So I decided to stop and try again next weekend. However, running circles around someone means something quite different. If you run circles around someone, you do something much better than another person or group of people. For example, she runs circles around all the other kids in her math class. And running circles around someone is completely different than running in the same circles with them. The word circle can also mean a group of people sharing a common goal or interest. You can also define these circles in a more detailed way. For example, you can call your family members your family circle. The people in your social circle are the friends with whom you socialize. You know, hang out and do fun things. If you hang out with people for a special reason, they can be in a special circle. Let's say two mystery writers know each other from going to the same events for many years. You could say they run in the same literary circle. Those in your inner circle are the most trusted people in your life. They mean more than your social circle. They may include your family members, friends, and professional colleagues, those who you trust most. Now, talking in circles does not mean you are talking with people in your circles. To talk in circles is to talk a lot, but to not make much sense. When you talk in circles, you may be trying to avoid a topic, so you talk around it. When we circle back, we revisit something we have already done or discussed. For example, let's say you bring up an issue at a work meeting, but there isn't enough time to discuss it. Your boss may say that the group will circle back to your issue at another time. And to come full circle is an expression that we use to describe something, such as an idea, experience, or career that has changed a lot only to find itself back to where it started. Imagine a dot that starts at one point on the outer part of a circle and travels all the way around, ending exactly where it started. That's what circles do. They go around and around in 360 degrees. We began our show with a simple definition of a circle, and now we have come full circle. Join us again next week when we circle back with new expressions to teach. I'm Ana Mateo.
Thanks, Ana. Now we present The Making of a Nation. This week in our series, Steve Ember tells us about America after the events of September 11th, 2001.
A stunning and cowardly strike on the United States. Terrorists and mighty skyscrapers crumbling to the ground. Many innocent people are dead. The president vows the killers will pay for this attack on America.
The United States changed as a result of the September 11th terrorist attacks. CBS newsman Dan Rather expressed what many Americans were feeling.
You will remember this day as long as you live. A series of coordinated terror strikes today at this country, its people, our freedom. Strikes that came without warning.
On the morning of that sunny September day that came to be known as 9/11, the nation came under attack from Al-Qaeda, an extremist group led by Osama bin Laden. Its targets were world-famous buildings representing America's economic and military power. Al-Qaeda operatives hijacked four American passenger airplanes. The hijackers were from Middle Eastern countries. Each group included a pilot trained to fly two kinds of Boeing airliners, the 757 and the 767. At 8:46 on that morning, one group of hijackers flew a Boeing 767 into the North Tower of the World Trade Center in New York City. 17 minutes later, another group flew a second 767 into the Trade Center's South Tower. The planes exploded in fireballs that sent clouds of smoke into the air. The intense heat of the burning jet fuel from the planes caused structural failures that brought down both buildings. About an hour after the first plane hit the World Trade Center, another group of Al-Qaeda operatives flew a 757 airliner into the Pentagon, the headquarters of the Defense Department in Arlington, Virginia. The plane exploded against a wall of the huge building where more than 20,000 people worked. A fourth group had taken control of another 757, but some of the passengers on that flight, United 93, had heard about the terrorist attacks through phone calls to their families. Several passengers and crew members attempted to retake control of the plane. It crashed near the town of Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Investigators later said the hijackers probably planned to attack the Capitol, a major government building in Washington, D.C., where Congress meets. There was also concern that the White House could have been a target. The 9/11 attacks saw the worst loss of lives on American soil since Japan attacked Pearl Harbor in 1941. That attack caused the United States to enter World War II.
The pictures of airplanes flying into buildings, fires burning, huge structures collapsing, have filled us with disbelief, terrible sadness, and a quiet, unyielding anger.
As expressed by President George W. Bush on 9/11, the attacks left Americans in a state of shock and disbelief. But that was soon replaced by anger and a resolve that such events would not be allowed to happen again.
These acts of mass murder were intended to frighten our nation into chaos and retreat. But they have failed. Our country is strong. A great people has been moved to defend a great nation. Terrorist attacks can shake the foundations of our biggest buildings, but they cannot touch the foundation of America. These acts shatter steel, but they cannot dent the steel of American resolve.
At Ground Zero, the site of the World Trade Center destruction, rescue efforts continued into the night. New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani was asked if Arab American or Muslim groups in New York might be targeted due to the nature of the attacks.
Just the opposite. They will receive extra protection. Nobody should engage in group blame. The particular individual is responsible and the group's responsible. That's up to law enforcement and it's up to the United States government to figure out. And citizens of New York should, even if they have anger, which is understandable, and very, very strong emotions about this, it isn't their place to get involved in this. Then they're just participating in the kind of activity we just witnessed. And New Yorkers are not like that.
And Giuliani spoke of the strength of spirit of the people of his city.
People tonight should say a prayer for the people that we've lost and be grateful that we're all here. And tomorrow, New York is going to be here, and we're going to rebuild, and we're going to be stronger than we were before.
On September 20th, President Bush went before a joint session of Congress to declare a war on terror.
Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated.
President Bush explained that the war on terror would be different from other wars.
Our response involves far more than instant retaliation and isolated strikes. Americans should not expect one battle, but a lengthy campaign, unlike any other we have ever seen. It may include dramatic strikes visible on TV and covert operations, secret even in success.
We will starve terrorists of funding, turn them one against another, drive them from place to place until there is no refuge or no rest. And we will pursue nations that provide aid or safe haven to terrorism. Every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists. From this day forward, any nation that continues to harbor or support terrorism will be regarded by the United States as a hostile regime.
President Bush demanded that the Taliban rulers of Afghanistan stop sheltering Osama bin Laden and surrender him. The president also called on the Taliban to close terrorist training camps in Afghanistan. The Taliban refused. They demanded evidence that Osama bin Laden had been involved in the attacks of 9/11. They said that if such evidence was provided, he would be tried in an Islamic court. The United States refused to provide evidence. On October 7th, the United States and Britain launched airstrikes against Taliban targets. What became known as the War on Terror had begun. Tribal groups from the opposition Northern Alliance led a ground attack. But suicide bombers had killed their leader, Ahmad Shah Massoud, on September 9th, 2 days before the 9/11 attacks. By November, Taliban control began to collapse in several provinces. Taliban forces fled Kabul, the capital. But the ouster of the Taliban government did not mean the end of the war on terror. Some of President Bush's advisors had long supported an invasion of Iraq. As early as October 2001, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld suggested that military action against Iraq was possible. Government officials accused Iraq of having links to terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda. They noted that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein had used chemical weapons, and they said he was seeking to develop biological and nuclear weapons as well. In October 2001, Congress passed the USA Patriot Act. This law provided the government with more power to gather information about suspected terrorists in the United States. Critics said the law invaded constitutional rights to privacy. Civil liberties groups said the Patriot Act gave law enforcement and other agencies too much power. In January 2002, President Bush gave his State of the Union report to Congress. He accused some nations of supporting terrorist organizations. He said the United States would not wait to be attacked by such groups. Instead, it would strike first at the countries that sheltered them. The president identified three nations, North Korea, Iran, and Iraq, as supporters of terror.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world. By seeking weapons of mass destruction, these regimes pose a grave and growing danger. They could provide these arms to terrorists, giving them the means to match their hatred.
In 2002, the United States opened a detention center at its naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Some of the fighters arrested in Afghanistan were sent there. They were not considered prisoners of war. Instead, the detainees were treated as unlawful enemy combatants. As such, the Bush administration said they did not have the same rights as war prisoners under international treaties. In the United States, the government also detained some foreign citizens, mostly for violating immigration laws. No terrorism charges were brought against these detainees. Human rights activists and some legal experts protested the detentions. After 9/11, government agencies were criticized for failing to prevent the terrorist attacks. Critics said the agencies should have been working together to gather intelligence. Government officials said part of the issue involved legal restrictions on the gathering and sharing of intelligence. The attacks of 9/11 had a major effect on the commercial aviation industry. The skies over Washington and other cities became strangely silent. Washington's busy Ronald Reagan National Airport was closed for several weeks after the attacks. When it reopened, new security measures for inspecting passengers and their belongings were put in place. Similar measures were enforced at other airports across the nation. Fears over safety among the traveling public led to a drop in the number of airline passengers. As a result, the airlines began to use smaller planes. Costly changes were necessary to harden the cockpit to prevent more terrorist attacks. The increased security led to delays and other problems, but slowly Americans began to fly again in greater numbers. But airlines had to work hard to win back the trust of the traveling public. One carrier, United, ran a low-key television advertising campaign in which actor Robert Redford, at the end of each ad, gently suggested,
"It's time to fly."
In January 2003, the Department of Homeland Security opened for business.
Maybe you see something suspicious, but you don't want to get involved. It's nothing, you think. Can you be sure?
There was a lot to do.
If you see something, say something. Report suspicious activity to local authorities.
Transportation security, immigration, law enforcement, border protection. It represented the biggest government reorganization in more than half a century. All or part of 22 federal agencies and departments were combined into the new agency. Its job, to keep America safe in a world that had changed in a single day. The War on Terror, which began after the 9/11 terrorist attacks on the United States, escalated in March 2003. When a coalition of American-led forces invaded Iraq. The mission, as stated by President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair, was to disarm Iraq of weapons of mass destruction, to end Saddam Hussein's support for terrorism, and to free the Iraqi people.
That's our program for today. I hope you'll join us tomorrow for another Learning English program from the Voice of America.